This is The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to The Guardian Football Weekly. Who wants fourth place? No one, it seems. Manchester United managed to hold Southampton as the Ralphs cancel each other out at Old Trafford. As every game goes by, fewer people have that sneaky feeling that Spurs will get a Champions League spot, again beaten by a better team. Could Wolves do it? There's a glorious opportunity to talk about Craig Dawson's half and half arm, green and red, but where does it start? It's as you were at the top, £1 million for anyone who can suggest a new subject matter for Manchester City's relentlessness, while Liverpool dig in for a rainy win at Burnley. They're still bottom, Watford haven't scored under Roy, and wins for Newcastle and Everton means those three we all thought might escape a couple of weeks ago will now definitely all be relegated. Chelsea are champions of the world as Azpilicueta gets an assist for the winning penalty by holding the ball near the spot for a bit. There's the cat did nothing wrong, Souness analysis, your questions, and that's today's Guardian Football Weekly. On the panel today, Jonathan Wilson, welcome.
Morning, how are you doing?
I'm all right, thanks very much. Hello, Troy Townsend.
Good morning.
Mark says there appears to be an error in the lineup. You've invited Troy on when Everton won. That's extraordinary times here, Troy.
Well, the party has already started, so let's see if it can continue all the way through.
Well, we'll get to that game. Paul McInnes, hello.
Hello, Max. How are you doing?
I'm well. It's very hard to get you on the pod after Norwich have won. I hope you understand.
Yeah.
We will try.
No, that's fine. I appreciate it. Thank you.
Let's start at Old Trafford. Manchester United won. Southampton won. Gary says, are the guests going to put effort in for the full show or tail off after 15 minutes? Three successive games, Manchester United have been ahead. They failed to win any of them. Leaks to the press from inside the club suggesting they're not happy with the coaching. The assistant manager is apparently nicknamed Ted Lasso. What did you make of this one, Paul?
It just seemed to be symptomatic of a greater malaise rather than anything sort of particularly indicative on that day. You know, you had Sancho. He's one of these players who appears to be coming into form, looking like the sort of player that United were hoping to add. Somebody with a bit of penetration, somebody who's direct. But then you have the continuing decline of, say, Harry Maguire elsewhere on the pitch. And it just appears that, I mean, it's obvious that Rangnick isn't doing a great job. And I think at this point in time, you might think, well, why did they sack Ole Gunnar Solskjaer for this? But I think the answer is at the top of the club. The culture comes from the top of the club. And until there's a proper strategy in place for how they're going to develop as a club and as a team, I think you can continue to expect performances like this. Saints, meanwhile, you know, they're in good form at the minute, and they are a team. They are well organised. Hasenhüttl has, you know, there's no star man, no key component to that team. They've got a system. They know how they play. And, you know, they're robust enough to hold on after half an hour of dominance against them.
And that's right, Troy, isn't it? I mean, we talked about it a bit on the pod after Southampton beat Spurs. They are a good, well-organised, well-drilled football team.
Yeah, very much so. I get frustrated sometimes at Southampton because of their last few performances and how, like you've mentioned there, how good they have been, how well-oiled, how the players look like they're enjoying themselves as well. I think that's the most important thing sometimes is players going on the field of play, enjoying themselves, carrying out the manager's instructions to a T, and getting good results. They always have this dip somewhere along the line, don't they? That's quite dramatic. So it's really good to see them in this form. They could have won it, to be totally honest. It was similar to the Spurs game. They probably could have won it, should have won it. Although I hear that Man United say that they could have been four up or something like that, which is just ridiculous, to be totally honest. They're a team without a rudder, without a shape. They're all over the place. They're very similar to Spurs. So whatever we do with Spurs, with Man United, we might as well do with Spurs, apart from just give a point to United. The culture at both clubs, the lack of kind of evolution of the clubs with the players, etc., is just, yeah, must be worrying for both those set of fans. But Southampton, definitely on the up, that's for sure.
Wilson, are you surprised that Rangnick hasn't seemed to have had an effect on this set of players?
Not especially. I mean, I sort of think the whole situation is odd that, yeah, he's somebody who had only had 1 year of frontline coach experience in the last 10 years. He's proved himself an excellent director of football, but that's not the job he's doing. He's got a squad that doesn't obviously fit his methods, and there's clearly tension and friction there. But I thought there was a lot. If you looked at the numbers, there's a lot quite strange going on Saturday. So you had Hasenhüttl being quite critical of United, unusually critical of an opposing side. You're saying they didn't have reverse gears and pointing out some of the flaws there. United had the highest XG of the season. So to an extent, if you look purely at the numbers, Rangnick was right that they could easily have been ahead. And yet, the experience of anybody watching that game was, this is United being terrible, which is where I think XG doesn't always tell the full story, that there's a psychological element that people who watch a lot of football, people in football, you can sort of feel it. You know when a team's playing well and when they're not, and sometimes numbers don't quite, in a one-off game, don't quite reflect that. I don't know. You just come back to United aren't playing well. They've become a team who just piss and moan all the time, which I think always suggests a team that's not comfortable with themselves. Southampton are playing with confidence at the minute. So the sense for me in that game, certainly once that first sort of 20, 25 minutes when United were on top was over, was that Southampton probably looked more likely to nick it. Certainly once they'd equalised, they did.
I guess it's hard, Paul, isn't it, to for anyone of our era, just to remind yourself that Man United aren't just going to win every game at home. Like even now, and it's been years and years and years, when they don't win a game at Old Trafford, I think, well, that's weird. But actually, it isn't that weird anymore.
No, I mean, I think even Norwich have won at Old Trafford, actually, now you come to mention it, since the Fergie days. I think we're going to see a lot of games over the course of this podcast, which are about teams who are playing with confidence and teams who are playing with determination against those who are not. And going back to what Troy said, I think that can be quite determinant in getting a result in the Premier League still, despite all the sophistication of our tactics nowadays. But the fact of the matter is, with United, that was Ferguson. That was Ferguson imposing his mentality on a club for, two decades. And that's incredible. That you've never seen that before. You probably won't see it again. And United are struggling to replicate it. I just go back to the same point. I think you can bring in Pochettino, who is, the one that the players all want, apparently, and I'm pretty sure he would want to go. But if he doesn't have a sense that he knows in which way the club's going to go in terms of its recruitment, in terms of its structure, whether it's going to be the sort of thing where they do parachute in a Ronaldo because that's going to get you the biggest social media traction, then, you're still going to have problems going forward. And you can't live on history in the Premier League. It just doesn't last.
Yeah, history and reputation count for nothing. I wonder, Paul, do you think Fergie sort of sensed that? Do you think Fergie's underrated?
I mean, yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's just because the nature of time, people start to forget already. I've seen him appear on telly occasionally and people have to say, former Manchester United manager Sir Alex Ferguson. It's like, no, Fergie is the biggest name in British football, full stop. That shouldn't need any explanation. But yeah, that's what happens. Things move on.
Duke of Yorkshire says, could you discuss Harry Maguire, please? I don't understand why he isn't criticised more. I don't know the last time he played better than a 6 out of 10. Slow, doesn't seem like a leader. 80 million, not his fault, I know. Troy, I feel like Harry Maguire gets a lot of criticism. I mean, I feel like it is talked about enough. I don't know about you.
I mean, it has done in recent times because the form has probably dipped dramatically. But there's been a consistency in that, in Harry Maguire. And his performances in an England shirt are definitely not mirrored by his performances in a Manchester United shirt. And the fact that he obviously holds the armband as well, so is supposed to be the leader, the director of operations, from, the manager to the captain, there's something definitely not right there. I always find it difficult to criticise individuals because you never quite know what they're going through. You never quite know, what is going on in their heads, etc. But, he gets kept putting out there time and time again. Solskjaer trusted him when he was injured, and that was probably the worst thing he ever did, because that, helped his downfall, to be totally honest. So Man United have got centre-halves that could come in and do an effective or even more of an effective job. But he's the captain, and normally captains don't get dropped or left out, do they? But I think the criticism is warranted just because of the way of the performances have gone.
I should mention the Bruno Fernandes missed punch. De Gea says, what deserved a red more, Bruno Fernandes' attempt at a right hook, or the fact he missed the punch so badly. But if anybody commits a foul that isn't given a booking a red card, you now get so many tweets from Arsenal fans going, look, there's another. That should have been a red card. You're like, it's not. There is not an agenda against you. Let's go to the Tottenham Hotspur Stadium. Then Gary says, is being first on Match of the Day two episodes running really the kind of consistency Antonio Conte is looking for at Spurs? Conte, he's going to be permanently rained on. That's what I feel. And just bedraggled as Spurs manager. Jimenez said Wolves are dreaming big. 4 points off fourth with two games in hand. You were there, Wilson. And do you get the sense that, I mean, Wolves are a bit like Southampton. Well-drilled, well-organised. Everyone seems to know what they're doing. And if they went on a decent run, they could threaten the top four.
Yeah, they could. I mean, the problem is goals. That they just don't score enough. So I think there's only... Norwich and Burnley have scored fewer than them this season in the Premier League. So they're on course for 35 goals if you project it over the season. No team has finished fourth with fewer than Everton's 45 goals in 2004-05. So, unless they suddenly get a flurry of goals, I'm not really sure where they're going to come from. I mean, Daniel Podence is clearly a really good player, but just never seems to have a shot, never mind kind of be going close. Huang came off the bench yesterday, so he's obviously getting back to fitness. And there was a time before Christmas when he and Jimenez seemed to have a decent relationship, so maybe that could bring them more goals. But if they don't score more goals, it'd be something unprecedented for them to take fourth with that. But the way they pressed, especially that first sort of half hour, was incredibly impressive. And to an extent, from a Tottenham point of view, it's the same as the Southampton game, that they just don't have anybody who's good enough in possession when they're under pressure. And I think that's been true with Spurs really since Dembele and Eriksen left. Both Wolves goals ultimately came from Tottenham's failure to break the press. The first one led to a free kick, which then led to a whole series of other catastrophes, which led to the goal. The second one was Lloris trying to play that pass to Ben Davies and sort of putting him under pressure by putting it behind him. I mean, Tottenham didn't actually play that badly, which is something that's Conte was actually surprisingly calm, I thought, after the game. That he sort of was making the point that, yeah, they played fine. They just gave away two really daft goals. But they're two daft goals that fit a pattern.
I mean, lots of impressive performances for Wolves, Troy. But their standout player was Hugo Lloris. He was brilliant for them. What's he doing in that first one? What's that punch about? What are you doing?
I honestly don't know. I mean, I've been a Hugo supporter since he's arrived, to be totally honest, and defended him when he did have really difficult times previously. But I honestly don't know what was going through his head. And obviously, he was still affected by the time he tried to pass that lazy effort out to Ben Davies. But the constant punching didn't help. The nervousness around the defence anyway needs someone to grab the ball by the horns and be the authoritative figure, just like we mentioned at Man United. Can I just raise something? Because I saw both Sanchez and Romero do this quite a lot. The defending with your arms behind the back, and they did it quite a lot with Wolves in possession in and around the 18-yard box. And I just think that unstabilises a defender. They're not really balanced enough. And I understand, with the way that handball goes, and I know we're going to bring that up later, so I don't really want to talk about it now, but surely it's not the way to defend situations, particularly when defensively you've been breached quite a lot lately. I don't know what the other guys think, but I just looked at them yesterday and they were more worried about putting their arms behind their back rather than going to press and defend a situation. Listen, Lloris pulled out a couple of really good saves afterwards. So, he kind of, I don't know about redeemed himself, but he kept the score down for sure. And yeah, Spurs did improve. But anyone got any thoughts on those defenders? Because, sorry, Max, but I just worry when you defend in that way, when that's your first thought process, is defend in that manner.
No, I think the rules have changed this year to make that less of an, to make you need to do that less. Like, the deflected shot ball, if your arm's in a natural position and you're defending and you're close quarters and the ball comes off you, that shouldn't be given against you. So it seems even odder, really, that they do that.
I think the problem is that is a Premier League regulation and it's not necessarily followed everywhere. So Romero, obviously coming from Serie A, where they've been very strict on handballs. Sanchez, I don't know if that's influenced by him playing in Common Ball World Cup qualifiers for Colombia. Because of a Cup of Nations... They seem to change. I mean, a couple of nations, they change the rules all the time, but everything. But certainly in the group stage, they were very, very strict on that. So you look at the penalty that Zimbabwe conceded against Senegal, would never have been given in the Premier League. I think the Premier League's got it right, that shouldn't be handball. I think it's really since David Ellery took over at IFAB. But we've got ourselves in this tangle where it feels now like we're going out looking, you know, can we give a penalty for that? Can we say that's an offence? Whereas what it should be is, has he tried to cheat? And if and if your hand's down by your side when you're trying to jockey a player or block a shot, you're not trying to cheat. You're just having a hand is not an offence.
I mean, it's possible that Sanchez and Romero both just aspire to be old English country gents who always go for walks with their arms behind. You have to have your hands behind your back as you stroll up your very expensive driveway.
So do you think we're going to start to see a load of raspberry and mustard chino shorts?
You're absolutely right. That could change Spurs' fortunes. They just wore corduroy trousers for the rest of the season. Joe says, if he promises to take Harry Kane out of his pocket for the Switzerland game, is Max Kilman due an England call-up? I always find it very hard to tell. We had this sort of discussion about Adam Webster. Maybe I just don't study them enough, Troy, but like, they seem like good players. I couldn't tell you if he's going to be the next England centre-back for the next 20 years or just have a reasonable Premier League career and then sort of disappear in a decade.
I think it's a difficult season, isn't it? You know, because we've got, what is it now, 9-10 months until the World Cup, and there's not a lot of opportunity to actually go and give or provide opportunity for players to kind of prove their worth. You actually want to mould your squad in every single game to be able to approach that World Cup with a settled kind of unit. So injuries aside, you know, I doubt whether they'll get call-ups, but you never know what happens during the course of the season and loss of form, etc. We don't normally leave players out for loss of form, do we? So they normally still continue to play for their countries. So it's an interesting one. And maybe this time around, Gareth might just be able to, in this set of fixtures that come up, might be able to utilise some of the players that haven't been utilised, that have had good seasons. You know, you have to reward people that have had good seasons, and he's definitely one of those.
Yeah, that's a great point you make there, Troy, because obviously the example being Harry Maguire. You know, Harry Maguire plays so badly for his club, is impeccable for England. And that sort of makes Southgate's point for him, that he knows these players, he can trust them, and he can bring them in even if they're not doing well at the club level.
And he has to pick Connor Cody because he's good around the dressing room, even though he doesn't play. He's a good bloke. So just, you know, it's important to have that. It doesn't really seem like, I'm not saying that sarcastically, he appears to be a very...
Your face tells us something different, Max.
No, what do you mean? Like, I've interviewed him. He seems lovely. I don't know Connor Cody. He seems like a very lovely man. Everything I've heard, he is a lovely man. You're trying to create a problem here, Troy, but it isn't a problem. I don't want beef with Connor Cody. I mean, I imagine if I did have beef with Connor Cody, it'd be really quite pleasant, because I'm not going to be confrontational. I doubt he would be either. Let's go to the King Power. Leicester 2, West Ham 2. Big talking point from this game was Craig Dawson's equaliser in injury time. Now we get a diagram with the player's arm, and it's red. It's sort of like really sort of like covered in blood where it is a handball, and then it's alien green where it's the shoulder or the T-shirt line. Is everybody happy that that was given as a goal? Paul, are you happy that that was given?
I'm not sure. My emotions are pretty strong in any direction, really. But I think it was a goal. Yeah.
Okay, that's fine. So is everyone happy with that? We can move on, or do we need a sort of?
Well, to be honest, it's more that I just don't know. Like when the ball strikes half above the T-shirt line, half below, which takes precedence? I don't know. And maybe referees have been told that half and half means you don't give an offence. But I can understand why Leicester were upset by that. I also sort of feel that, and this is complicating things perhaps more than it needs to be, but I sort of feel it matters whether it hits the front of the shoulder or the side. Like, the side feels more offensive than the front. Because if it's hitting the front...
It's slightly fleshier, you think? The bicep is okay. One of the biceps are handball, I guess, is it? So we're here, like...
Yeah, I mean, you're pointing. I mean, it doesn't really help, does it, in an audio medium? But
no, it doesn't.
No, I think if it hits the front, it's quite near to hitting the chest. and maybe is hitting the chest as well. Okay. Whereas if it hits the side, it's not actually near the part of the ball you can legitimately, part of the arm you can legitimately play the ball with. So,
I mean, this was very army from Dawson. This seemed like a very army arm.
I thought it was. I mean, had I been the referee seeing that, I would have given a free kick to Leicester. But as I say, I don't know what the regulation is. It felt like a handball.
Leicester keep conceding from set pieces, Troy. I sort of sometimes wonder, as soon as anyone concedes from a set piece anywhere, instantly every defender is, you know, picked apart for every possible thing they could have done. Can sometimes it just be a cross that happens to land where the attacking player was running? Because, you know, sometimes that's what will happen with the flight of a football and the timings of people's runs. Or is it always defensively a mistake? No.
We never pick up on the quality of deliveries. We never pick up on the quality of movement in the box and then someone getting their head or arm, half of their arm to it. It's always almost like you've just said there, Max, a defensive mistake and defensive error. But both sets of teams will have spent a lot of time in defending the situation, in attacking the situation. So no one has the right to either defend it very well or attack it very well that ends up in a goal. So I think there's a lot of nervousness around Leicester because, you know, it was 2-1 again. It was that time in the game, wasn't it? And I actually felt that a goal was coming. It was one of those where you just felt that the nervousness around keeping that lead that late into the game after the Spurs experience would probably lead to something. And the controversial manner, I'm with Jonathan. I don't know whether that's a goal or not. I would just say, why don't you head it rather than try and put your arm on it? But it's one of those things where, again, I just think that, you know, they brought Vestergaard on, didn't they, to do a job. And that's probably the job that they brought him on for, is to make sure that anything into their box was cleared and cleared really well. It didn't happen. You could pick holes in it. It's one of those, you move on. To be fair, I thought their second half performance, Leicester, was very, very good. How they changed their approach to the game and took it to West Ham. And Harvey Barnes joined in because he was anonymous in the first half. But he joined in and all of a sudden, I don't know who got man of the match, but he definitely was one of those for sure, because Koufal had a really, really tough job. And you can tell by the fact that they hauled him off and put Ryan Fredericks in to try and deal with him. But yeah, I thought the turnaround for Leicester was good. Listen, goals are scored from set pieces. Goals are conceded from set pieces. Goals are cleared from set pieces. It's just one of those things.
I'd like it to have Wilson and Troy been the ref and the VAR, and they'd both just gone, we don't know. So the game would still be taking place now. Wouldn't it? Worth pointing out, Youri Tielemans had a really good second half as well. And when he's on it, is an absolutely tremendous player. Kurt Zouma was picked, felt unwell in the warm-up. Richard said, given Graeme Souness's views on the Zouma affair and his actions on the pitch over the course of his career, does the panel believe that Graeme Souness likes cats more than humans? There's two brilliant quotes in that. I mean, clearly, Graeme Souness, like most of us, found that video pretty distressing. But when he said, I mean, that cat hasn't done anything wrong, as many people have pointed out, makes it sound like he's like, you know, someone's given a foul against the cat and he hadn't done anything wrong. And the other thing he said was that John Bruin picked out was, you know, when he said West Ham's roots are in the East End of London, salt of the earth people, the vast majority of whom would not be accepting of what they saw. I wonder which team Kurt Zouma would play for that Graeme Souness would say, well, you know, they are Bristol Rovers fans, so they're really into this sort of thing. Or like, they're Fulham fans, they're quite posh. So really, they, you know, they like fox hunting, so this is just the next step up, isn't it? Anyway, I enjoyed that tremendously, even though I understood what he said. I also don't want beef with, I want beef with neither Connor Cody nor Graeme Souness. Let it be clear.
I was going to say, you can add Bristol Rovers and Fulham fans into that as well now, yeah? You're not doing well today, are you?
I mean, are we sure that a cat can actually do anything wrong? I mean, does a cat have moral agency? I mean, this is what I'm not sure about. I mean, you can project that sort of onto a cat and blame them for things, but whether they had a clue or not, nobody knows.
That's a good point. And had they done something, you know, had they, occasionally my cat Orlando, you'd come downstairs and the butter dish would be broken on the floor and Orlando would be looking quite innocent on the table. But it didn't take Columbo to work out who had broken the butter dish. But then, even then, I don't think, you know, in the Graeme Souness world, is that, well, the cat has done something wrong. So then suddenly it sits in one half and done it in the other. Exactly. Anyway.
Weirdly, as we were discussing that, the cat that lives four doors down has just come and climbed onto my terrace.
Yes.
Uh-huh.
Cat may not have moral agency, but that cat clearly blames me because it used to sort of just crawl under the fence. But just where I've moved my plants, it's much harder for it to do that now. So it has to hop up onto the wall, then onto the fence and over. And every time it sees me, as it hops on the wall, it stares at me as if to say, why are you making me go through this hassle? Why have you blocked up my other entrance? So the cat itself may not be able to do wrong, but it is definitely a deuced wrong in me.
That's something for the Super Sunday panel to work on next week, isn't it? And that'll do for part one. Part two, we'll start with the relegation dogfight. Welcome to part two of the Guardian Football Weekly. Now we're running a special offer on the Guardian Weekly magazine. Subscribe and save 50% off for 3 months. Special offer is only available until Sunday, the 20th of February. The Guardian Weekly magazine is a roundup of world news, opinion, and long reads that have shaped the week handpicked from The Guardian and The Observer. In a chaotic world, Guardian Weekly will help you find clarity. It's available wherever you are in the world, can be delivered to your door. Don't miss your last chance to subscribe to The Guardian Weekly for 50% off for 3 months. Visit theguardian.com/weekly-sub. And it includes a long read by Paul McInnes on the moral agency of cats. So
you what?
Something to look you forward what? To. Get on with it. Let's go to Carrow Road. Norwich 0, Manchester City 4. You're a Norwich fan. Paul, come on, tell us all about it.
Oh, I mean, it was just, I was furious before the game because, you know, A, I captained Kevin De Bruyne. I thought I'd out-pepped the Pep factor. I thought there are some constants in this team. Cancelo, Kevin De Bruyne, if they're fit, they're going to play, right? Drops them both. Plays Nathan Aké, a clear sign of like, I'm not taking this match seriously. I mean, as it turned out, Nathan Aké was one of the best players on the pitch. Fantastic, had a fantastic game, really graced it. But I thought, oh, this is a sign of disrespect here. And for about 20 minutes, I thought, aha, you know, we've taken that. We've pinned that team sheet to the dressing room wall and we're giving him some. Grant Hanley hit the base of the post. Could very close to going in and we could have taken an unexpected 1-0 lead. But in the end, I mean, it was another 15 minutes and we coughed up a mistake, 1-0 down. And then it was game over really after that. Dean Smith said it was the second goal that killed us, but really it was the first because we just couldn't withhold because City were so relentless. And this is, you know, a pretty much a scratch team with, you know, a false nine. And they brought on, I think KK got his first game for City, and they brought on, you know, the two other Mackety and Delap as well. So the kids came on in the second half, but you really couldn't tell that much of a difference. They're just so well oiled, so well drilled. I'm not one of these guys who I am on the wrong side of the argument about whether I enjoy watching City or not. I prefer what there are other teams in the Premier League I prefer to watch, but there's no team that's better. And you know, it was engrossing really just to watch them do it. I wanted to ask Jonathan actually a question, which was who's written the best on Guardiola's coaching, on what he actually does on the training field?
Well, in terms of sort of in-depth sort of inside knowledge, Marty Perrineau has two books, one when he was at Barca, one when, was the other one when he was at City or when he was at Bayern? I think it was when he was at City. They go in real depth. I mean, it's clearly written from a very pro-Pep perspective, but you know, in terms of the detail of what he does, I'd say those two books are by far the best.
Thank you very much. I will read your books.
Having
read none of them.
And yeah, I mean, obviously, once I've read all of Wilson's books, I'll read those. But for those who haven't read those, Wilson, what do they? Because we hear sort of superficially, like he's you know obsessive, he's relentless. But do you sort of feel he does? He's doing things that no other manager is doing, like to get this set of players. Clearly, they're a brilliant set of footballers. But to get them to be just so consistent, what's he doing?
I suspect even those books, although they go into a lot of detail, are pretty superficial. I think necessarily so. But I mean, something that Guardiola does that I'm not sure anybody else does is, let me get this right, he divides a training pitch into 20 zones. So it's four 4-by-5. And then there's certain things like you must never have three players in a line. See, you know, you should always only have one player in each zone, you know, unless you're deliberately creating an overload or you're pressing. But you should never have three players in a horizontal or vertical line because that's cutting down your passing options. So it's, I think it's about teaching players to think about space on the pitch in a different way, which is where the juego de posición, which is the, you know, the term Guardiola prefers for rather than tiki taka or whatever. It's all about that positional sense. But what I think is interesting about that, and where it differs from what's gone before, is you can only do that if you have really good pitches. If you have the boots and the balls are really high level, if your players are really high level, so you're taking the first touch for granted. And I think it's only really from his Barcelona, so what, 14 years ago, that it's almost like treating 11-a-side as you treat 5-a-side. So you know when you're playing 5-a-side, you sort of assume that people's first touches are going to be fine because you're playing on AstroTurf, because you know the ball's not traveling that far. And that means you can move the ball around quicker, and it's all about the intermovement of players once you get to a certain level. Well, he's transferred that to 11-a-side. Now, clearly, if you're playing at the baseball ground in 1971, you can't play the game that way. So it took a whole series of developments in terms of equipment, in terms of pitches, in terms of physical fitness, to be able to impose that. And that's why he was so revolutionary when he did that. Because he was doing things that had never been possible before, as nobody had considered doing before.
But he's also, you've also got to sign players who are smart, right?
Yeah.
Because that's quite, you know, if I'm thinking I'm playing and then suddenly I'm caught in a line of three, like at any random time, you could be in a random set
of positions. And I think that's why even very good players you see take time to adjust. So Riyad Mahrez took a year to adjust. Grealish is going through that process of adjustment now, and maybe he will, maybe he won't. I think you saw David Villa at Barcelona. It took him a year to get used to thinking about the game in that way. And it's not just thinking about the game in that way. It's assimilating that to the point where it's instinctive. Because if you're constantly having to think, then obviously you're not thinking about the game itself. And I think you've seen that with Grealish the first part of the season. There's a lot of times when you get the ball, you can almost see him stopping and think, right, what do I do now? And plus, we agree this year, simple things like Cancelo tend to go inside him, whereas at Villa, the fullback would go on the outside. And so again, that changes movement, changes where the passing options are.
I think that Jack Grealish thing strikes me something that does get to a little bit of why you might not fall in love with the City, because I think there's also the option where the primary concern is to conserve possession. The first thing Grealish has to do is stop. To make sure he doesn't risk the ball at that any moment in time. And Grealish's game, particularly for Villa the last few years, was to do the risky thing straight away, to act to try and progress further. Whereas every player in that City setup, first thing they do is preserve the ball, make the ball safe. Do you think? Because that's the way I'm watching it, I think.
Yeah, well, what's interesting there is how different it is to Klopp's approach. Because Klopp would want, when you have a turnover, he'd want to attack as quickly as possible, hit the opposition when they're on the back foot, before they've been able to set. Guardiola's happy to do that, but if it doesn't happen within two or three passes, he's like reset and will play from essentially a fixed position. And he would say it would take, I think he said it takes 15 passes to get into that set position again. And then he's confident enough that once you're in those patterns, his side is still good enough to break you down. But if you can't get the turnover immediately, and if you can't mount the counter straight away, he would rather wait, reset, go again. And I think that's what gives City that sense of sort of quite stifling control, the slight sterility that a lot of people don't really warm to.
Thought of every Saturday, Sunday amateur footballer thinking 15 passes. The thought of putting a 15, that's to get 15 completed passes in a match.
But that's exactly the point you have to have a certain level of player playing on a certain level of pitch with a certain level of equipment. That is just a matter of course. But what I think is interesting more generally in the game now, and I was talking to somebody at CM Red Star about this, when was that? Back in October? Because I went to their game against Ashington because Sunderland's game against Oxford was called off. And the level was way higher than I was expecting. What is the 7th tier, 8th tier? But it's that point about the pitches are now way better, even at that level, because of, you know, different technology. And some players from a very early age are passing out from the back, and they're starting to think like that, even down at that level.
One more thing to add to that. I got a really interesting line from a guy called Luke Tufts, who I interviewed. The interview ran yesterday. He is the most...
Yeah, Leatherhead manager.
Exactly, yes, highest ranking openly gay manager in British football. But he can talk the hind legs off a donkey about the game. And he was saying that, you know, this progressive football lower down is partly to do with the fact that you've got coaches who have come through the academy system and who are wanting to break into the game, have to break into that level. But anybody who's come through that system and has done their A badges that way is going to have learned to coach in a particular way, which he says is with the aim for ultimately contributing to the England system, the England, you know, age levels and up. But that's another reason why non-league teams are playing like that.
It'll all come full circle. 4-4-2. Hit the channels. Let's go to Turf Moor, speaking of which. Slightly harsh. Burnley played well, didn't they? A rough old day up there. Do you think Burnley will feel a little disappointed to get nothing from that game, Troy?
Yes and no. I think compare the two games, Norwich are going to be massively disappointed because of the manner of the defeat and the scoreline. I think Burnley, yeah, will wake up this morning. Sean Dyche will wake up this morning slightly disappointed, but actually more infused in the way that his team took on Liverpool. And, you know, again, we'll talk about set piece, won't we? A set piece goal has won the game. They had opportunities. A couple of those really were offside. So as the play goes on, we talk about something that was actually offside and should not really influence our thinking on what those chances, you know, how those chances came about. But again, bottom of the table, they're like, you know, they've taken on Manchester United and Liverpool and shown up really, really well. And I think that hopefully will bode well for obviously the games that they have to make up and what they have in hand. So it's not catastrophic. Obviously, they'd like to have taken something from the game. But like I said, if you look at the two, Burnley and the Norwich game, you think, right, Burnley, you know, they could look set for, I don't know, picking up more results than not, to be totally honest.
Wout Weghorst had that one chance, didn't he? He doesn't strike me as a dinker of footballs, you know, and he didn't dink that one particularly well. I liked Fabinho afterwards when, you know, he scored 5 in 7, saying, I'm surprised.
Yeah.
It was just not some nice honesty from Fabinho. Let's go to Vicarage Road. Watford 0, Brighton 2. Watford yet to score a goal since Roy Hodgson took charge 3 games ago. Vintage Roy, this is, isn't it? Let's fix one end before the other. They were booed off at halftime and full time. How very Everton of the Watford fans. Is it bleak for them, Wilson?
Yeah, I'd say so. I don't know. Look, I mean, Roy Hodgson's pulled teams out of very bad positions before. He did it at Fulham, he did it at West Brom. So it's not impossible. But I think as well, if you look at the other teams around them, they all seem to be improving at the moment. Yeah, they've got a clean sheet under Roy, which is something they haven't done for a long, long time. So that's something. But they looked so flat, so lacking in attacking nous that yeah, you do worry for them.
Neil Mopar's finish was great, wasn't it, Paul? I don't know what sort of loop.
He shinned it. Come on, volley. Top of shin.
You think it was a shin? Shin. Oh, okay, all right. I take it back. Neil Mopar's finish was lucky, wasn't it, Paul? That massive shin,
yeah,
into the goal. You don't need to answer that.
He shinned it. Totally shinned it, mate.
Totally. What a shin. Everton 3, Leeds 0. Come on then, Troy. Troy was standing there at the end, shirt off, singing Frankie Lampard, weren't you? Everton 3, Leeds 0.
I cannot believe we're near the end of part two and you're only just talking about Everton, although you have dropped in some sly digs along the way. listen, it was a really good performance, but it was a really good performance from everyone that wanted Everton to win in that ground. And that massively includes the fans. They create an atmosphere and environment that was difficult for Leeds to handle, which is, I find, quite surprising. But they have an important part to play in the rest of this journey. And it just shows how much they didn't buy into Rafa Benitez and everything that he brought to the club, or the way that he wanted to play, because it was Rafa Benitez. Obviously, I was at the Merseyside derby and the atmosphere was on a par, but Liverpool knew how to deal with it, you know, and they scored early doors and, you know, they quietened the crowd down, and then the rest is history. Leeds didn't know how to deal with it. You know, Everton pressed high. They were in their faces. You know, they were acting on mistakes. They've scored another set piece goal, which was quite unusual. They've kept a clean sheet, which again is unusual. Although those two attempts from Rodrigo, wow, on another day, they both go
the
in.
First
they,
one. Oh, so good.
They were unbelievable, to be honest. And that was at a time when Leeds, again, were not impressing on the game at all, you know, and he's pulled two out the bag, which, you know, I'm calling them on target, and I know the stats don't, but we won't go back there again, that's for sure. And then they took Rafinha off at half-time. Bielsa took Rafinha off at half-time. And no Leeds player was having a great game, but you still think that if any Leeds player is going to unlock the door of the opposition, it's Rafinha. And I thought he might have been injured. Apparently he wasn't. It was tactical. I didn't understand the tactics, but, you know, rather than focus on that, Donny van de Beek, what a great start for him. The kind of player that is very mature in his thinking, and you kind of appreciate that because of, you know, where he's come from. And I don't mean United, I mean the club that he came from before. You know, kept the ball really well. Possession was much better. And then obviously picking the pockets, and, you know, big shout out to the likes of Alex Iwobi and John Joe Kenny, you know, unsung heroes that have had a tough time. But the whole the team was first class. The whole team was first class on the day and deserved the victory, no doubt.
Michael Keane scored on the same day as twin brother Will scored for Wigan. First time both have scored in English League football on the same day. Thanks to Opta for that stat. Michael Keane said Frank Lampard has changed the intensity that they train at. I've never heard a player say when a new manager, the manager's come in and the intensity's really dropped. But what has Andros said about life with Frank Lampard in charge that you're allowed to tell us?
That I'm allowed to tell you, not very much, to be totally honest, apart from what he's put out into the public domain. But listen, different managers bring different things. We've spoken about coaching today, and Frank is obviously part of that new breed of younger coach. What he's done, he's made them more offensive. He wants them on the front foot. He doesn't want them sitting back, and a pressure being applied to their defence. The intensity in the sessions are all about keeping and loving the ball, you know, which kind of, you kind of think, well, what was it before kind of thing, you know? So, but he's got a way of playing. He's got a style of playing that he wants to impress on this football club. And that's, the fans are going to benefit from that because they want to see the club on the front foot. They believe that Everton are a big football club and should be playing games on the front foot and not potentially sitting back and watching things happen, a la games against Burnley and Southampton, they would say, when they were at home. But so it's a turnaround in terms of those players having to change their mentality as well with how they approach the game. And two home games he's had so far, obviously one in the FA Cup, they've scored 7 goals, which is a remarkable turnaround. And people will look towards the Newcastle defeat and think, well, you know, it's not all going well. There were particular reasons for that. But yeah, the definitely possession of the ball is so much better, which means then you create more opportunity potentially, which means then you have more ball in the latter third of the pitch.
It's Southampton away, then City at home, then Spurs away, then Wolves at home in the league next. And I think what we saw at Chelsea with Lampard was, you know, great on the front foot, and he obviously had a lot of real attacking options, and you saw them all on the team, you know, and more off the bench. You know, Dele Alli played really well when he came on, by all accounts. But, you know, get beyond those guys, start getting them into the reverse gears, as Ralf Hasenhüttl might say, and there's probably questions still to be asked about the Everton scene, which we'll find out about.
Yeah, questions for Leeds next 3 games: Man United, Liverpool and Spurs. So that they could get dragged into it. Newcastle, meanwhile, have won their last 3. Bob says, are Cambridge responsible for kickstarting Newcastle United's ascent to dominate world football? It was all our fault. 4 points clear the relegation zone, those 3 wins in a row. What's Eddie Howe done, Wilson, apart from buy some better players?
Yeah, I mean, they brought in 4 players who are better than what we've had. I think Trippier particularly has been really impressive. His free kicks and his delivery from corners are a massive threat. You know, I know the goal on Sunday was a little bit fortuitous and a bit odd in terms of Buendia's positioning sort of off the side of the wall and then running onto the side of it. But yeah, Villa didn't really offer anything. Newcastle closed them down really well. So I think there's greater energy, greater purpose there. And I think it's not just that the 4 players have come in, it's that they've sort of given everybody there a new lease of life. That they've sort of broken that sort of cycle of stagnation that was there.
And I suppose that's credit to Howe, because we spoke about this a lot, about the motivation of those players. Why are they going to be motivated to perform well? Because it just means they're going to be sold and get someone else in. And the fact that they are performing, and okay, they may have bonuses attached to staying up, etc. But that is an impressive sign that he's managed to motivate the rest of the players while bringing in new players. I guess that free kick was odd, wasn't it, Paul? In that it went in the middle of the goal. And like Wilson said, I don't know what Buendia, what's he doing? What can we call that particular role, to be about kneeling, sort of like he's going to be knighted, and then jumping up with a pelvic thrust? It's just an odd thing to do on a football pitch.
One assumes he was told to do that. I don't know. I mean, he's not particularly effective in the defensive third. He tries, but really puts himself about. But quite often, for Norwich, was responsible for giving away a lot of ball and a lot of fouls. But so I'm sure he was trying on this occasion too. I mean, I thought this was another game where the real, you know, goes back to what Troy said at the very top of the pod. You know, this is another game where the real deciding factor was, you know, belief, attitude, and desire, and that Newcastle had the energy from the off. Newcastle had the desire to win the ball. I'm not sure they had much more of a coherent tactical plan than Villa, but they believed it, and that was enough to get under Villa's skin. It's interesting that, you know, there's a little bit of the shine coming off the Gerrard moment already. And what I thought was quite striking was that when, and maybe this is not giving, maybe I should be giving Howe more credit, but when they cut off those options, but Newcastle pressing the back line of Villa, it nullified the front end of the pitch too, because he's playing with these two diminutive-ish number 10s behind Watkins. There was nobody to get the ball out to. There was no way of actually making that team tick. And by that, you know, they stifled them for long enough that by the time they came to the second half, and Newcastle's levels dropped, Villa were a bit lost and didn't really know what to do.
Brentford 0, Crystal Palace 0. Crystal Palace without a win so far in 2022. Christian Eriksen was introduced to the fans before kickoff. He'll feature in a friendly on Monday. Melvin says, am I the only one convinced that Brentford are going down in a Blackpool started well then really tailed off fashion? Obviously, now they've signed Eriksen, I hope they don't, but I really believe they will. Wilson?
Yeah, I mean, they've had no wins in 7 now, I think. Is that right? And I think they've lost 6 of those, haven't they? So it was a clean sheet, which I guess is a step in the right direction. But I think the big worry for them, and I know you touched on the fact that XG is significantly higher than the number of goals scored. But I think sometimes that's a sign of bad luck and there's going to be a regression to the mean. Sometimes it's a sign that we just don't have any forwards. And when Ivan Toney's not there, it's very hard to see where the goals are going to come from.
All right, that'll do for part two. Part three will begin with Chelsea winning the Club World Cup. Welcome to part three of the Guardian Football Weekly. Chelsea 2, Palmeiras 1 after extra time, winning the FIFA Club World Cup. They've won every trophy since Abramovich took over, every available one. He was there to watch the game, was Abramovich. James says, his penalty decoy, the new team role after draft excluder, and after a while, will it get really annoying when every team does it? Yeah, there was an interesting thread from Gerd Jordet, if I pronounced it correctly, who's a football psychology researcher. He wasn't the only one to spot this, but when Chelsea got the penalty, Azpilicueta acted as a decoy. He picked up the ball and stood on the spot as if he was going to take it. I mean, my first thought is, surely if you're Palmeiras, you know that Azpilicueta is not going to be taking this penalty. So that is, you know, put someone else who might have a chance of taking it. But anyway, the Palmeiras defence all sort of surrounded him and annoyed him, and they got booked and they were pushed away. And then Azpilicueta just gave it to Havertz, who'd been minding his own business or just getting himself in the zone to take the penalty. It was quite an interesting moment, I thought.
Yeah, for me, it's only one you do when you don't really know the opposition players and who the penalty takers are. I don't think you can consistently do that. You know, putting pressure on Azpilicueta when they look around the pitch and think there's far more confident penalty takers than the Chelsea captain. So I'm not
tricky in the mid-90s where Jeff Kenner holds the ball and Matt Letizia's over there going, oh, well, I'll hassle him. Letizia's never going to take this penalty, is he? Do you think that's it then? It's done. We've seen it. It was fun, but it'll never happen again.
Listen, it's like those things, isn't it? People start to copycat, don't they? So all of a sudden you might see a few clubs, particularly in Europe maybe, decide that, you know, when they play in European competition, decide that, you know, we'll trick them in this way. But the amount of kind of research that goes into penalty takers now and you know, the goalkeepers and what they do, it could only be in a competition like that, and maybe like a European competition where there may be a little bit of copycat. But I don't see it catching on like wildfire, if that's your question, Max.
And is it not also saying that Kai Havertz couldn't handle being bullied by defenders around the penalty spot waiting to take his kick, so they needed to give him some... I mean, you know, you'd note that one down if you're an opposition coach, wouldn't you?
But no, what I really like the idea of, you know, is you know, the next time that Azpilicueta is holding the ball, the opposition defence have to try and work out who's going to take the penalty and just start crowding around Kai Havertz, who's just standing on the left wing. And then he doesn't take the penalty. And then it just becomes this, you know, they're looking around going, who do you think it is? Like a sort of weird, it's like a murder mystery.
And it's Kurt Zouma's cat.
Exactly. Right. What else do we have to say, talk about? So, I mean, so the question is, you know, is it interesting that we're talking about this game after we've done all the Premier League games? And should we be? Do you think in years to come this trophy will take on more importance in English football or not, Wilson?
Well, I mean, the reason that we're not talking about it is that we can see that the level's not as high as the Premier League. That, you know, Palmeiras, you know, they've won two Libertadores in a row. They're clearly a very good side. But fundamentally, if you're an Argentinian or a Brazilian or a Chilean or a Uruguayan player, and you're any good, as soon as you hit 18, 19, 20, you're off to Europe because that's where the money is. And that's the problem of a global game. So, yeah, I've just come back from a couple of nations where one of the big talking points a couple of days before the final was the CAF Congress, where they okayed the African Super League, which will be a 24-team tournament. And Gianni Infantino is talking about, you know, billions of dollars being invested in it. And you sort of think, well, I'm not convinced that's the right thing to do in terms of what it does to domestic competition. But you're also sort of thinking, still, who's going to watch that? Where's the money coming from? Because, yeah, everybody knows that the best football's played in Europe and the best African player is going to want to play in Europe, and that's where the money's going to be. So even if you bung $1 million, $2 million, $5 million, doesn't really matter, into an African tournament, it's going to have to go a very long way to catch up with Europe. So FIFA want to expand the World Cup to make it this 24-club tournament with teams from all over the world. But fundamentally, the European teams are going to be richer and better.
I love the way Troy is unplugging his laptop. He has places to go that are more important. This is a scene. Just trying to make a sharp exit. Are you okay for 1 minute,
yeah,
Troy? Or do you want to... Yeah, you're okay? Okay, silence.
Yes, I am. Yes, I am.
Maybe that was a decoy charger, not the actual charger. You were just trying to catch me out. Wilson, any strong thoughts on Alex Neil taking the Sunderland job?
I mean, it's fine. He obviously did a very good job at Norwich. Did a very good job at Preston. So in that sense, good appointment. I think the problem is that the club have messed it up in that they let the Keane stories get out there. So I think with Keane, it was always going to be a huge gamble. I'm not sure it was going to be the right thing, but it was an exciting thing. And so whoever came in then was going to, I mean, realistically, whoever came in was going to feel like a anticlimax. So immediately Alex Neil begins with this sort of sense of, There's also the bizarre manner of the appointment, the fact that there was photographs of Alex Neil wearing a Sunderland tracksuit, standing on the platform at Durham Station for several hours before the club announced the signing. So, I mean, I quite like the idea they're getting Alex Neil lookalike to wear a Sunderland tracksuit while they appointed Zinedine Zidane or something.
Or they looked around and they asked, who already owns a Sunderland tracksuit?
Is that the decoy penalty taker, by the way? Yeah.
but then more seriously, there's all these questions now about who actually owns the club. Kirill Louis-Dreyfus has, you know, supposedly last year took over the club. He's never revealed exactly what percentage he owns. We were told at the time that Charlie Methven and Stuart Donald, although they retained a small shareholding, had no position of executive authority. And yet Charlie Methven's been sat next to Kirill Louis-Dreyfus for the last two games.
And also because Charlie Methven has been spending most of his time teaching Christian Romero and Davinson Sanchez how to walk properly down country lanes. Anyway, look, that'll do for today, won't it? Good luck to Steve Bruce, who's taking his first game in charge of West Brom tonight against Blackburn. I mean, I cannot believe he hasn't managed them at least three times before, but there you go. That'll do for today's podcast. Thank you, Wilson.
Cheers, thank you.
Thank you, Troy.
Always a pleasure, Max. Thank you.
Thank you, Paul.
Yeah, ditto. Always a pleasure, Max.
This show was produced by Joel Grove. Our executive producer is Daniel Stevens, and our listeners are you. So you're the important ones. Thank you for listening to it. We'll be back. Champions League, so we'll be back on Wednesday.
This is The Guardian.